This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Good morning. From today, more Australians will be able to give the life-giving gifts of blood and plasma. Gay and bisexual men and transgender people in long-term monogamous relationships now eligible to donate blood or platelets for the first time, because gender-neutral questions are part of the rules from today. Tell me how you're feeling if you're now someone part of this community that can now do this, but also if you're a long-time blood donor. If you're chatting to a first-time donor, what would you tell them? 1300 222 774 is the number to call. Tell me and tell them about how rewarding it is, maybe your tips as to how to fit it into your day, what do you do while you're there, how often do you do it. I'm Mary Guerin, this is the Conversation Hour, and I'd love to hear from all of you everyday heroes, you altruistic angels out there who give blood and plasma. Maybe you've benefited from those donations. I'd love to hear your story. So we'll talk this morning about how significant this latest move is, how this has taken this long for it all to happen, a little of the history there. It is a big step for donations in this country. Also, it's day one of term two, and your kids have, in an ideal world, already trotted off to school, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed. If they've trotted off to a public school, teachers there are planning various forms of industrial action. Yes, this continues what happened before the break. There are going to be bans on written comments in student reports for parents. They won't be implementing government initiatives. What else will they be doing? We're going to be hearing about it. I want to hear from you. Does this move the needle in terms of your support for the teachers' push for more pay and better conditions? To remind you, as we headed into the break, everything was at an impasse. The Australian Education Union is asking for a 35% pay increase over 3 years. The government offered 17% over 4 years, I believe, plus a 1.5% overtime allowance. We're going to touch base with the union and see what they have planned and how that might affect you and your kids. And I'd like to hear from you how you feel about it. Also, how much do labels like eco or vegan influence your buying decisions? Specifically, we're talking today about whether vegan leather is really sustainable. We know it's marketed as ethical, but is it sustainable? Tell me your thoughts or comments about vegan leather. In this hour, we're going to hear what's sold as vegan leather is still largely plastic, often derived from fossil fuels. It can be difficult to recycle and slow to break down. So are consumers being misled by that label? Is this another case of sustainability being more about marketing than reality? Or tell me if the term vegan influences you. I'm asking you also about what advice you'd give for first-time blood donors, more parts of the community now able to give from today. Gary in Langwarrin South, you give blood regularly, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I donate. I'm donating plasma nowadays. I used to donate platelets a fair bit, but I'm donating plasma fortnightly now. I gave my 314th donation last Thursday at Frankston.
Oh, whoa!
And that is, I can't explain. It's just a really good feeling knowing that you're helping people you don't know.
Yeah. How old were you when you started, Gary?
Oh, probably 20.
Yeah.
But I stopped for 10 or 15 years for other reasons. But
you do it for the feeling.
I've been donating regularly now for probably the last 20 years, I suppose.
And what would be your tip then for people who are first-time donors?
Oh, just make sure you drink plenty of water and relax. Just relax and just in the knowledge that you're helping someone.
Oh, that is fantastic advice, Gary. Good on you, and I'm sure there'll be everyone who's listening to this applauding you as well. I'd love to hear if you're like Gary, what sort of feeling you get from blood donations. This is because every Australian who wants to give blood will be asked gender-neutral questions from today, which brings in a whole heap of our community that can donate from today. We're going to be hearing about how significant that is. But your story, 1300 222 774, is the number to call about that. We will get to that very soon. Also in this hour, we're going to be talking, yes, about vegan leather and what's going to be happening in our schools. But also, many more of us are walking these days because we're all adapting to the fuel crisis, and it means more commuting potentially to our work with our work gear. Have you started looking for a backpack or wanting to update one that you've got? How do you choose one, and how important is it to get the right one? This hour, you can call me with your questions or observations about backpacks, because I'll be joined by an expert who can talk about the perils of getting bad ones as we try to protect ourselves as we take up active transport. Your texts are coming in about giving blood. This from Jerry: yes, I really enjoy the feeling of superiority. Wonderful. Next, let's hear about a new stage of accessibility, more people potentially feeling that superiority, giving blood in Australia. Joining me now is Dr. Bryant Coe, Medical Director and Product Safety at Live Blood, and to talk about these changes to blood donation rules and forms. Hi, Bryant. Thanks for joining us.
Morning, Mary. Thanks for having me.
Tell us what exactly is changing from today.
So what's changing from today are donor eligibility rules, which are another step towards donation equality, following on from changes to rules from plasma donations in July 2025 to help progress inclusivity for blood donors while still maintaining the safety of the blood supply. Essentially, as you mentioned, what this involves is all donors will be asked the same sexual activity questions or gender neutral questions. This includes whether a donor has had sex with someone new or more than one person in the past 6 months, and if the answer to this is yes, whether they've had anal sex in the past 3 months.
So effectively what it means is, because this form has changed, gay and bisexual men and transgender people in those monogamous relationships, I guess that's still being asked, whether it's monogamous and beyond 6 months, is that right? And then that constitutes long-term. They will not be asked anything that rules them out, so it makes them eligible from today.
That's correct.
And monogamous in the long term, that 6 months presumably has a medical reason behind it?
That's right. So when we come up with these rules, it's based on research and modelling, and the process involves an assessment of the risk, regulatory approvals and logistics. When we look at risk, what we consider is the risk particularly of transmission of HIV. And we know that transmission of HIV risk, based on our local data, is highest in the first 6 months of a relationship. We also know that the risk of transmission of HIV is higher through anal sex, and there are some limitations of the testing that can be performed to reduce the risk, and what we call this is the testing window period, where an individual may be infected with HIV, but even the most sensitive test that's available will not pick it up.
So tell us why then this change will also not compromise safety.
So safety is our number one priority at Lifeblood, and part of that, apart from our risk assessment and ensuring that we have adequately looked at all of the data that's available and modelled what the risk will be, is also involves a regulatory approval process. So we have had approval by the Therapeutic Goods Administration, or the TGA, our regulator, and governments who also assess the risks and ensure that it is safe.
It's 14 minutes past 11. You're listening to Dr. Bryant Coe. We're talking about the new eligibility, as it were, all up around blood donations from today. Why has it taken this long, Bryant?
That's a great question. So, again, because of the process that involves the assessment, the regulatory approvals, and finally the logistics, there is a process to ensure that it is safe and inclusive. So expanding a little bit more on the logistical aspect, so once we had done the risk assessment, had granted approval by the TGA, There then is a logistical process to change changes to legal systems and documents, and also staff and training. One of the things that we had introduced, of course, was the plasma pathway in July in 2025, mm-hmm. and that was the initial step, I think, that would that helped pave the way for this change.
Indeed. So that was the first step last year. I think I read that that has brought in, since then, that time, 3,000 more people into the system. Correct me if I'm wrong, but also how will this change today affect the numbers of people potentially giving blood and blood products?
That's right, Mary. So with the plasma pathway change, we saw 3,000 new donations and almost 10,000 donations, new donors and 10,000 donations. What we anticipate from this new change is that we expect that there'll be an additional 20,000 additional donations as part of this current rule change.
Yeah. Just one last question before I let you go. This from Ken on text. Why wouldn't they just ask if a gay or bi man is on that PrEP, that prophylactic medication to prevent HIV? What would you say to Ken about what is the virtue of this gender neutral questionnaire?
So the virtue of the gender neutral questionnaire is truly to allow more inclusivity when it comes to blood donation. We already know that the plasma pathway has been a groundbreaking change internationally to allow donation of plasma for donors who are on PrEP, that pre-exposure prophylaxis medication to prevent HIV.
Mm-hmm.
The risk is different for blood and for plasma, and we know that undetectable equals untransmissible for sexual transmission for those who are on pre-exposure prophylaxis. And we know also that pre-exposure prophylaxis can change the testing dynamics and the testing sensitivity, but those rules don't necessarily apply for blood.
And as a final question, as journos like to say, how many other areas of the community are still ruled ineligible at the moment for whatever reason that presumably you'd like to see, taken away some of those limitations?
We're always looking to progress inclusivity for our blood donors. You've mentioned, it's such a life-saving, life-giving thing to do. We constantly review the data, and as part of this change, we'll continue to monitor the data to see whether there can be further changes to the rules, such as reducing the wait time, for example, once we have that data available.
Yeah. Dr. Bryant Coe, thank you for giving us that insight this morning.
Thank you, Mary.
That's Bryant Coe from Lifeblood. Joining me now is Matthew Littlejohn, who's president of the Melbourne Chargers, which is an inclusive rugby team. Hi, Matthew. Thanks for joining us. How do you feel about this news today?
We're super excited. So we've had the Chargers rugby team here at Lifeblood Melbourne CBD since about 9 o'clock this morning, getting in chairs and doing a big team blood drive.
That's terrific. How many?
We've got about 13 guys lined up to come through throughout today, and then another session later in the week. Our guys are just so excited to be able to get involved with this new stage of the process.
Why?
It's meant a lot to our team and our community. Rugby players, we shed a lot of blood on the field sometimes, and so it's important to restock the supply where we can. But no, it's really meaningful that this is a step that has boosted inclusion within our queer community, and it's something we've just been waiting so long to be able to do. So it's so exciting to finally be able to be here and donating.
We heard from Gary straight off the bat this morning talking about the feeling that he gets from giving blood and donations. Has it been something that you've thought about before yourself, Matthew?
One of the things, one of my longest memories was the school blood drives, and the blood van would come around. When I was in high school and going through the coming out process and realizing I was gay, I always felt quite excluded, and I wasn't able to go to the school blood van. And that's always been a bit of a memory. And so now when they started talking about these changes, the feeling of actually being able to come into the donor centered donate plasma for the last year and now blood, just like everyone else in the community. It's just been so wonderful to feel that inclusion.
What are your plans? Are you hopping in the chair yourself, Matthew? And if so, have you got how are you going to amuse yourself there while you're giving blood?
My trick is always Wordle and crosswords on my phone. I'm travelling overseas tomorrow, so I got my donation in last week, so I'd be fine to jet off. But I'm here sort of wrangling our players to make sure we've got arms in chairs ready to donate. And like I said, the whole team just got so excited when this new round of changes was announced, and the whole group chat lit up with people wanting to be involved.
That is so heartening to hear. Rugby players spilling blood in the best possible way. Matthew, thank you for giving us an insight and good luck to all of you and your team.
Thank you.
That's Matthew Littlejohn, who's president of the Melbourne Chargers. Frank from Hawthorne says a blood donation gives you the same feeling as changing the oil in your car. I guess that's one of satisfaction, Frank. That's how I'd think of it. Jeff says, I've donated well over 300 times. A couple of years ago, I went on medication for possible prostate issues. Is that still an issue? Yes, I think you'd have to ask about that. There are some exclusions, obviously, for some good reasons as well. Holly from Yark says, donating blood's such a feel-good. My only issue is I live in a regional area and find it's hard to donate without needing to travel 1 to 2 hours. And I was asking you your tips for first-time donors. Kurt from Port Melbourne says the best thing is the party pies and sausage rolls after donating. Good on you. I'm sure Matthew and his team will be looking forward to that, if, of course, they do eat party pies. I am talking about vegan leather as well this hour. You're already leaning in on that. Someone's calling it a scam. Remember to stick around for that conversation. Also, we're talking about good and bad backpacks as more of us are walking. I keep those calls and texts coming in about the blood donations. But also, we're talking very soon to the Teachers Union to say what's going to be happening. It's day one of term two. What's going to be happening in your kids' public school? It's 22 minutes past 11. Next, let's talk about what makes a good and bad backpack.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
It's 774 ABC Melbourne. If you have any questions about backpacks, how to choose one, how to prevent a strain if you're now suddenly starting to walk a bit more to work or wherever you need to commute to because of this fuel crisis, I'd love to hear your questions. Joining me now to answer those questions and give us advice is Professor Suzanne Snodgrass, who is Head of Discipline in Physiotherapy at the University of Newcastle. Thanks for joining us, Suzanne.
Thanks for having me.
Are you in your practice or from what you hear, hearing of more people taking up active transport, as we say, in light of this fuel crisis?
Well, I think that is pretty common. I haven't necessarily heard of it more, but we certainly see the students walking a lot more.
Indeed. And what would you be telling your students about what to look for in a backpack?
Sure. I don't think it's the actual type of backpack, except that you do need to have a backpack that has two straps, and important to use both straps. So there's some biomechanical studies that show that your posture does change when you're just having it on the one strap. And theoretically, that might lead to some back pain. So really important to use both straps. And when the load is quite heavy, keep the weight really close to your body. So have it in the back part of the backpack near the straps. And if you distribute it that way, you can also use the chest strap and the waist strap to keep it as close to you as possible.
We're talking to Professor Suzanne Snodgrass about it. She's from University of Newcastle. So you mentioned there the straps. Let's go back a couple of steps. How important is it that you have both chest and waist straps?
It's more important when the weight is heavy. And I should also mention that a big issue with backpacks is the actual amount of weight that you're carrying. So if you can try to limit the weight, that's really good. But where you have more weight in the pack, that helps you keep that weight closer to your back by using the chest and the waist strap.
And so have you got any window, you know, estimation of how heavy is too heavy, or how do you figure it out?
Yeah, most of the studies suggest around 5 to 15% of your body weight is the maximum you would want to carry. And it is based on body weight, because obviously someone who's quite small isn't going to be able to carry as much weight as someone who's larger.
Mm. And if people are starting to do this more often, maybe they've never done it before, or they're needing to carry, for instance, a computer where they never had to before, how do they get themselves, from a physiotherapy point of view, how do they get themselves up to being able to carry heavier weights?
Oh, that's an interesting question, one I hadn't thought about. But I think one of the main things is regular physical activity. So when we look at studies that look at whether or not, you know, carrying a heavy backpack causes back pain, there's not really strong links there. And that's because there's a lot of other factors that lead to the back pain other than just carrying the backpack. And one of the important things is physical activity. So I think general physical activity, both cardiovascular and lifting weights, will help you increase your strength and make it easier for you to carry a backpack.
We're talking about backpacks, what makes a good one or a bad one for you. Suzanne, the straps that go across your shoulders, is it important where they actually sit, and how do you figure out what's best for your body?
Yeah, so having a slightly wider strap for those straps is better. I think they looked at different centimeter lengths, and like the wider strap was better because that distributes the weight across your shoulder. The other thing with the straps is tightening them enough so that the weight of the backpack is sitting higher on your back, and that will make it more comfortable to wear.
Should we be putting the things in the backpack in that, you know, should we be thinking about the order in which we pack our backpack then, and making the heaviest things higher? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that would be helpful. I mean, sometimes you're not really able to, but certainly if there's pockets near the top, that would help. Trying to distribute the weight close to your back and higher is better. And I think you asked me, like, where to place the straps on your shoulders. That's a little bit hard to describe, but just kind of close into your shoulder is probably better than like across the tips of your shoulder, I guess I could say.
Closer to your neck than your actual outer shoulder.
Yeah, it's just keeping the weight close to the center mass of your body.
What about size? Does it matter if it's, for instance, a light pack but a long one? What would you have to say about how that works?
In terms of the size of the backpack, again, it's thinking about the placement of the weight. So if it's quite a light pack but it's still hanging way down your back and kind of sitting on your waist, it's not going to be very well distributed. So having it the weight higher will be better.
If you are, it sounds like a lot of what you're saying is you have to get that feedback from your own body. If a pack is actually causing someone discomfort, is that a definite sign that you should do something different, that you should abandon doing it? How do you assess it?
Yeah, so sure, you shouldn't really, if you're getting immediate pain when you're walking around with your backpack, you know, after 10 minutes, then you know that something's not quite right. So you could go to a physio and get them to assess how you're wearing it. The other thing you could try is using one of those roller suitcases or packs that have a roller. Now, with the rollers, important to make sure that the handle's long enough so that you're not bending over to roll it.
So give up on a backpack altogether, potentially.
Yeah. I mean, that's one option.
Can a good backpack actually help you with your posture, or will it always be a little bit of a fight against an unnatural force?
I wouldn't say that a backpack will help you with your posture. If you wear it correctly, you can keep the same good posture that you would have without it on. So you can manage to maintain or not change your posture with it on. But I don't think it would improve your posture unless just putting it on makes you think about having your shoulders back because you're strapped in.
So Suzanne Snodgrass, what would you have as a general tips for people who've started walking more generally on their spine and back health? We have been talking in recent weeks about self-sufficiency. It's a buzzword now because of fuel costs and so forth. If people are walking more, whether or not with backpack or rollers or whatever, what would you have to say about tips they should follow?
Yeah, I think a really important thing is the shoes.
Yeah.
You know, if you, say, work in an office where you've got to wear nice heels or something, you don't want to be walking a long distance in those. Wear other shoes, change when you get to work. So you want to have supportive shoes that have some cushion and some support. And that'll make a really big difference to your comfort in terms of walking some distances.
Mm. And a last question from text here, Suzanne, do you not carry the weight on your hips rather than waist or higher? I guess that we're talking about the really big backpacks then, aren't we?
If you have a really big heavy pack, you're going to have the waist strap on and that weight is going to distribute across your hips and your shoulders. So you will get quite a bit of weight on your hips. I guess I'm thinking more about the everyday packs that people might carry to the office that have a laptop in them and not much else. Those oftentimes won't have a waist strap, and so sitting those up a bit higher is going to be helpful rather than having them right down at the waist and kind of pulling your shoulders backwards.
And so some of the more fashionable backpacks that don't have, well, at least a waist strap, maybe not even a chest strap, what would you have to say about them?
Yeah, making sure those shoulder straps are tightened up so that that weight is sitting, if you imagine, kind of between your shoulder blades. Mm. I notice, you know, my daughter a lot because she carries one of those to school and she has quite a bit of weight in it and she just lets the straps loosen up and then it's hanging down halfway down her back, kind of sitting on her hips. And I'm like, that cannot be comfortable. Just tighten the straps up.
Surely she's got to listen to a mum who's a professor at the University of Newcastle. Professor Suzanne Snodgrass, thank you. Good luck with your daughter and thanks for giving us some tips today.
Okay, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's Professor Suzanne Snodgrass, who is Head of Discipline in Physiotherapy at the University of Newcastle. We will very soon be talking about those school kids, particularly in Victoria, because Term 2 has begun and we need to figure out what's happening with that industrial action from teachers. Also this hour, we've been talking about blood donations because more amongst us are now going to be eligible because of gender-neutral questionnaires. This on text, please donate on my behalf. I can't donate anymore since being pregnant and now breastfeeding. My advice is don't look when they put in the needle and make sure you enjoy the yummy food and drinks. And this, thanks to all blood donors, I donated in the past but now require 3 blood donations every 3 weeks just to survive. Again, good on you, all of you who can donate and do so regularly. It's just lovely to hear about. It's 27 minutes to 12 and next, let's figure out what disruptions we can expect this term in public schools.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, the Australian Education Union Victoria did say that if there wasn't some sort of movement with the state government in the wage and condition talks, that we could expect more industrial action this term. Term one has begun. Joining me now is Justin Mullally, the president of the AEU in Victoria. Thank you, Justin, for joining us. What can we expect?
Good morning, Mary. Well, there's a range of things that teachers, education support staff and principals will be putting in place as part of an escalation of our campaign. But I wanted to say from the get-go, we're not in this position because we want to be. We're in this position because the government is not doing anything that will actually address the fact that our schools are the lowest funded in the country and that teachers are the lowest paid, education support and principals are not paid properly either. So the campaign is in response to the fact that the government hasn't done what they need to do. But I'm really happy to talk to you about some of the impacts that that might have.
Mm. Just to go back a step, I believe that the state government had said that it wanted to keep the talks going throughout the break. Did that happen?
Yeah, definitely. We've met very frequently throughout the school holidays.
And no progress?
Well, there's certainly lots of discussion going on, but we're not at a point where we can say that there is going to be proper funding for our schools and proper paying conditions for the workforce.
Can you remind people what you want?
We're looking for a significant increase in terms of pay. Victorian teachers are the lowest funded, the lowest paid in the country. An experienced teacher in New South Wales will be over $15,000 better off by the time we get to October. We can't have a gap like that. That gap must be closed. And in terms of workload, school staff do around about 12 hours per week of unpaid overtime. We need to have some measures in place that would actually address that excessive workload. They're the two key issues.
You're listening to Justin Mullally from the Australian Education Union. We're talking about what your kids in public schools might be faced with, the impact. Justin, to go to that impact in particular, you've announced a ban on written comments in student reports for parents. Is that right? Is that universal and is that starting today?
Yeah, that's right. So report writing will really commence in a lot of schools over the next couple of weeks. And of course, in those schools that do it this way, those reports are published and provided to parents towards the end of the term. These days, those schools don't provide written reports to parents in a uniform way. There are some schools that do it on much shorter cycles. So the ban applies to teachers providing written comments on student progress and work.
So what does that mean? They'll just be left with generic kind of descriptions?
Yeah, that's right. There might be a description of the learning that's been going on, which is about the curriculum, for example. And it would be also some information about the progression of the students. So some numerical assessment, if you like, of how well the student's gone in the course, in the subject over the first couple of terms.
That numerical assessment you're saying will be missing? Is it?
No, that
will be still included, but you won't have that more qualitative feedback.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The hours that many teachers put into that work is something that they're just not prepared to do when they're not being respected by the state government.
I guess, Justin, my question might be, if I'm a parent hearing that, I'm thinking, well, look, that the lack of qualitative feedback is really going to potentially affect my kid. Not every kid, not all the time, but that goes to the welfare of the kids. What would you say about that and whether or not that should be brought into industrial action?
Yeah, we're making sure that every student receives all the feedback that they need individually. There will be nothing that will restrict a teacher from providing students with that kind of feedback. What teachers won't do will be writing that up in a way that will be provided to parents because of the amount of hours, the unpaid work that that usually involves. There will be still, though, ways that parents can engage with teachers. Of course, there will be things like parent-teacher interviews, which schools routinely do at different points of the year. Mm. They will certainly be available to parents so they can engage with their child's teacher. Mm. They're important moments so that we can really make sure that there is that partnership there. It just won't be, at this point, in the form of written comments.
Justin, I just want to get to the other two things quickly that you've said will happen. The teachers won't implement new government initiatives in school. Well, that's tautological. You should. So what does that really mean?
It means that we're trying to be clear, Mary, and making sure that if the government wants to roll out something that isn't in place in our schools, then we simply won't do it. How can we go about doing the government's work when they won't respect our work? Mm. That's not something we can stand for.
And you've also said that there will be rolling stoppages and they're kind of random. They'll take people by surprise. Is that right?
Yeah, they're certainly rolling stoppages. There'll be half-day stoppages that will affect different parts of the state on different days. That will go for many, many weeks over the course of the term if it needs to. All of this is predicated on the fact that government needs to do something. The ball's in their court. They need to act. They need to put something on the table that will resolve this dispute. If not, those half-day stoppages will occur. There'll be multiple days per week where there'll be stoppages. All of this, though, will be available to parents so that they know if their school or their child's school is going to be affected.
They will get notice
in advance.
How much notice will they get?
Well, we have our first stoppages planned for the 6th of May, and we will be in a position to make sure that schools can advise as early as this week.
Right, okay. And this on text, will the kids get feedback or written comments? I guess that texter is asking whether that will happen in between those reports.
Yeah, so the usual set of arrangements are that teachers will provide written feedback and other forms of feedback on tasks that students do. That will continue. That won't be affected by the ban.
Justin Mullally, thank you for your for that insight. I do just wanted to run also this text past you. The comments on the kids' reports are all cut and paste anyway. My kids get similar comments, but with changed names, teachers need to lift their game if they want more pay. That's AJ from Ballarat. What would you have to say to AJ?
AJ needs to understand the work that teachers do routinely. When they're working 12 hours unpaid per week, they're not just doing their job, they're setting up and sustaining a system on unpaid volunteer labour. That's not tolerable. And we know that in terms of reporting to parents, that's a really valuable thing in terms of the assessment that teachers do of student progress. And we know that that involves a lot of hours. And that often involves a lot of hours around the assessment of student work that will continue.
Justin Mullally, thanks for your time.
Good on you, Mary. Thank you.
That's Justin Mullally, President of the Australian Education Union Victoria. 1300 222 774. If you'd like to say whether any of that will be bad for your kids, if that moves the needle at all for how you're feeling about the teachers' claims when it comes to wages and conditions. Peter in Tarradale, what did you want to say?
I wanted to say that I've got a 20-year-old who's always wanted to be a teacher, has just been accepted into VU, and everyone she says to, I'm going to be a teacher, says don't do it, including all the teachers.
Oh, why?
Because it's underpaid and overworked, and they're saying the mental health stress is enormous.
Is your kid going to continue with it?
She wants to. She's understanding it won't pay as much, but as a father and my wife, we're concerned about the demands. Even in when she did work experience, she was doing unpaid extra work voluntarily, not forced on her, but she did it because it was just the way the school run.
Well, that's really interesting insight, Peter. Thank you for letting us know, and best of luck to your daughter as well. This on text, Victorian teachers always compare their salaries with those in New South Wales. The cost of living in New South Wales is higher than in Victoria. Really? I'd like to see if that's actually true as well. Claire says, we reschool reports. While I was teaching in northeastern Victoria, on average, only 20% of parents looked at their children's reports. The school could check because they were sent electronically. Oh, maybe it doesn't mean as much. It is 17 minutes to 12. Very soon, we are going to be talking about vegan leather. It is sold as ethical. Is it actually sustainable? Colleen in Viewbank, you are a consumer of vegan leather. Have you found it?
I have inadvertently bought like summer weight sandals and lightweight shoes from a very, very, very major participant in vegan leather. And in both cases, they the inner lining, the inner sole, just breaks up.
Oh, how for how long?
To take them to my trusty cobbler, who's then had to check with me. I can fix them, but it'll have to be leather. Is that a problem for you? No, I said, it's not a problem. So he's done the leather inner soles for me, and they're perfect.
Oh, so how long did it take for them to start degrading, Colleen?
Oh, 5 years maybe. Five
okay.
Years. Not with, and I, it's one in particular, not a lot of wear. However, it just breaks down. So anyway, that's my experience.
That's your first-hand experience, Colleen. Thank you so much for leaning in. Yes, we will be asking if vegan leather is the eco-friendly choice many people think that it is. This from Joan, I've seen a garment labelled vegan wool. Good grief. Yes, I'm sure this will open up a lot of different opinions about the vegan leather marketing. I'd like to hear from you. How much do labels like eco or vegan influence your buying decisions? It's 11:45 and we're going to ask, if vegan leather isn't sustainable, what is?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Look, a lot of us have gone towards vegan leather for a lot of things that we buy because, you know, no animals have been harmed. It's better for the planet. We believed a clear ethical win. My next guest is going to tell us it's not necessarily true because of how it is actually made up. Are consumers being misled by the label? How do you choose your shoes or anything else? Like Colleen was telling us before, what has been your experience with that vegan leather? Associate Professor Carol Tan is in fashion entrepreneurship in RMIT University and joins me now. Thanks for joining me, Carol.
Thank you so much, Mary, for having me.
What have you found about the sustainability of vegan leather?
Well, firstly, I guess we need to understand what exactly is vegan leather. Mm. And traditionally, it has been PU, which is polyurethane or PVC. And at the moment, there are other plant-based inputs. For example, have you heard of pineapple leather?
No.
So there's pineapple leather that uses pineapple leaves that would normally be thrown away after harvest, or apple leather that comes from apple skins and pulp that is left over from the juice or cider production, or grape leather, which is grape waste, which is skins and stems from the wine industry. There's even cactus leather, can you believe it, that is made from harvested cactus leaves rather than waste.
Right. So vegan leather, if I'm buying something called that, unless I'm really being told or go digging around, I'm really not knowing what is making that vegan leather vegan. Is that
exactly
right?
Exactly. Yes, that is true. And so these plant materials, you think like, oh, I'm being really green, but they can't actually function on their own. For example, in terms of apple leather, they need to make the apples dry, they crush them into a powder, and they combine it with PU. Because apple leather cannot hold on its own, you need a PU as a binder. And it actually surprised me to find out that 50% of apple leather is made of PU.
50%? Is that
50%?
So would that be some of the highest?
No, actually, the highest is cactus, 65%.
Wow. Okay, so tell us why that's important. Why does that mean anything in terms of something being environmentally friendly?
So you see, the problem is that without the PU leather, as I said, that it will absorb, the material would absorb moisture, it would tear easily and simply fall apart. So vegan leathers today are made of the hybrid and composite materials. And I don't know whether have you seen this, that it starts flaking?
Yes, I have.
Yes, so it's, yeah. And I was just looking in my cupboard the other day. I was like, oh my God, now it's just flaking. What can I do with it? I can't do anything. And it ends up becoming microplastics. And then it goes into the ocean. And then, you know, they've got that whole life cycle. And then it gets into the sea and whatnot. But at the end of the day, we can't even donate this to any of the stores because they don't want it. Mm. It can't, you know, the product can't stay for long in use. The cracking, the peeling and flaking would only be after a couple of years, depending on how they're used, how they're cared for. And once that starts, it cannot be repaired. And, you know, you were just talking about real animal leather that can be repaired. And, you know, it lasts a really long time.
Just as an aside, I have had some leather jackets that have also peeled as well. Probably something to do with how I've stored them, and it's probably user error. But leather itself is how much more durable in that sense?
I've heard of people using leather jackets that can last up to 30 years.
Mm.
So, you know, to be sustainable is keeping the product in use for the longest possible time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what would you have to say about using vegan as a marketing term and what that tells consumers, how you see it playing out?
I feel as though that consumers need to educate themselves or become a material detective and look beyond the word vegan and try to understand what the material is actually made from, because vegan can be 100% PU. I was just in Chadstone last weekend. I was shopping. I saw this jacket. It said, we are vegan. And then when I looked at it, it said 100% PU. So am I really, as a consumer, buying this because it's a cool innovation that I'll keep for years, or am I sold on the green dream that, you know, I'm actually half plastic? So you really need to think about the durability and the repairability of that material. And there are some vegan leathers that are already doing that.
Mm. It's 10 minutes to 12. You're on The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne, and we're talking to Carol Tan, who's an associate professor at RMIT University, and we're talking about vegan, sustainable versus ethical, I guess, Carol, is a sort of the uncomfortable nexus of what we're talking about, isn't it?
Yes.
You're asking about what a consumer asks themselves as they look at a label. Most, I potentially would say, would argue that they're making a choice, for instance, not to hurt an animal versus sustainability. Even if they rip all of the, you know, the false marketing away, that is a choice, nonetheless, that people can make.
Yes. And I can give you some examples of other types of vegan leather that have zero plastic content.
Oh, please do.
Yes. So there's this material called Mirum, and it's made of rubber, cork, and coconut. So this is the gold standard. There's no plastic coatings. There's no glues. It's used by well-known brands, and it's it also develops a patina over time, very similar to leather. But the problem is it's expensive.
How do you spell that? Mirum.
Mirum. M-I-R-U-M.
And so at the moment, how available is it to, for instance, Australians?
Oh, there are brands, there are Australian brands like Belroy that use this. And you also have other brands globally like Stella McCartney and Camper that also use this material. It's just that it's not available in such big quantities and it's more expensive.
And presumably the brands that do use that or other more sustainable vegan materials, do you think that that's going to become more and more important as knowledge about sustainability of vegan leather more generally is exposed?
Definitely. I think that the industry needs to move towards this. There are also other types of materials, which is this thing called banana tex. Have you heard of banana tex?
No, I haven't.
It's made of abaca, banana stalks. It starts in the Philippines, so it's a sustainable process, started in the Philippines, and then it ends in Taiwan. But also, again, very expensive brands that use it. It's 100% plant-based technical canvas. So it started as a canvas material. And there are other brands such as H&M. So H&M has it, even though it's not an expensive brand, but it's only in their certain lines. It's called an innovation stories line. So there are brands that are trying to adopt this, but it's not mainstream yet. So the problem is we need to make it more mainstream.
So do we need clearer regulation around what things are called?
Definitely.
What would you like to see?
So like, for example, you know, the ACCC, they are trying, they're going to be investigating a brand if they say that, oh, is it eco-friendly? Okay, yes. If it's eco-friendly, then you have to start proving how are you eco-friendly? Are we actually misleading the consumer? Think about the entire life cycle of the product, just not at the beginning, because, you know, for example, it could be certain processes where in the beginning is more, you know, it impacts the environment. But what about the end of life? What are you going to be doing with the garment or the bag? Is it going to be thrown away? Then you're actually creating waste sooner rather than later, and it's never going to break down.
Mm. I guess just to play devil's advocate as well, Carol Tan, if we're asking the question, look, am I going to use this a long time? How long will I use it? How much will I use it? Is that not more important even than, you know, what it's made from? So in other words, if we use it a lot and then falls apart, is that not better than, for instance, choosing another material, you know, when we're not necessarily going to be using that product a lot? It's more about, you know, how much it's that nexus of eco-sustainability and consumerism.
Yes, but the thing is, if you're going to be using it a lot and it falls apart after, like, for example, 2 years, then you're just creating waste sooner and then you have to buy that bag over and over again. So,
Carol Tan, I bet you've got a really great sustainable wardrobe behind you. If listeners do can take away one thing from this, what should they be thinking? Should they be sceptical about vegan materials, or is there still a way they can actually approach this and buy with a bit of confidence?
I think that when you look at the word, it is something that you need to see, is it 100% plastic or is it 80% plastic? What are you actually paying for? So you know that you need to make a choice based on material honesty.
Yeah. Someone is actually saying on text as well, Andrew from Hampton Park says, you shouldn't be calling it vegan leather at all because leather comes from animal skins. It's like saying soya milk. Milk, yes, I've heard this argument before, Andrew. I guess you would agree, Carol. You can't have, you know, vegan bacon. You're in that camp.
Oh, I've seen like vegan chicken, you know. Yes.
Thank you so much for all of your tips, Carol. Really appreciate your insight.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Associate Professor Carol Tan in Fashion Entrepreneurship at RMIT University. Your texts, vegan leather is made of plastic, leather's a byproduct. Use up our leather, great material. And this as well, a student at RMIT made a whole range of fashion out of rabbit skins from her Western Victorian area, a full-blown pest, and campaigners brought her range down. Interesting. I think there's going to be a lot more knowledge about all of that as we go forward. And Stu from Mernda has reminded us of a quote from Red Simons, a lot of vinyls died for this jacket. Yes, your texts have also been coming in about the teachers as well. Gemma from Camberwell says, while I will be highly negatively affected if the teachers strike with juggling my kids and work, I fully support our teachers. Strike, strike, strike. It is day one of term two. We will keep our eye on that as the term progresses. Thank you for joining me on Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne. Have a look on the ABC Listen app if you'd like to listen again. Have a wonderful day out there. Take care.